I am Gaius. Germanicus is here. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. We're in Londinium, and we're about to talk Plato. So if you're fair warned, you could leave. It's a live talk in the 21st century. There are not many of us who want to contest Plato and what he meant in the Republic. But it comes back to classicists, and every once in a while they want us to read their books, and we do. I recommend a new book, James Rahm, professor at Bard College. It's called Plato and the Tyrant. It's actually based on activity of Plato. Three times he visited a city-state, Syracuse, on Sicily, a very powerful Syracuse at the time. This is 4th century BCE. After Sparta defeated Athens and before Alexander marched. And there's a connection to Alexander here. Plato founded the Academy. Aristotle studied at the Academy, and Aristotle was tutor to Alexander and his older good friend Ptolemy. So there's a connection. However, we're going to concentrate on Plato at the end of the Republic. Now, Plato's idea was here to give advice to government, what government is best and how. He'd come up against the 30 tyrants in Athens that had led them in despair, because they wanted democracy. But the 30 tyrants included one cousin of Plato, so he felt it personally. And he wanted to make recommendations about what is a good government. And he had this idea. He didn't invent this term. That was 18th century philosopher King. He was talking about, when is a man not a tyrant? When is he a good leader? They had the word king, but they didn't use it routinely. And he came to the conclusion that a good king has philosophy and understands the nature of government and has authority because he understands the nature of government. Practically speaking, however, it came down to tyrant after tyrant after tyrant, and that's the lessons of Syracuse. I welcome Germanicus's thoughts here. What I mention, because it's often left out of the discussion of the Republic, and you college students have had to read it. We did too when we were in college, and I haven't thought about it that much for 50 years, but here it is. At the end of the Republic, Plato tells the story of the myth of Ur. Ur was a man's name, and there was a battle somewhere, and everybody died, and the corpses were left on the field. When the families did come to collect the corpses, they collected Ur, but he sat up. He wasn't dead. And they go, what is this? Everybody's decomposing. You're alive. How did this happen? And he told this story, that he'd traveled to a place that was astral-like, stars all around, no particular land. He was moving across it. And he kept on this journey, he got very thirsty, dry land around him. And they came to a river, and the river named the River of Forgetfulness. Those who drank deeply of it forgot everything about this transition from death to life to life. But if you drink just modestly, you can remember. And therefore what you're remembering is about the higher life, beauty, justice, the forms. You're also remembering that reincarnation is all. And then you pass the river and you get to a decision point, not unlike in Harry Potter, where you get to choose what college you belong in. The hat tells you. All right, you get to say what you want to be in the next life. I tried animalism. I wanted to be a Springer Spaniel, but professor said, no, it has to be human. The irony here is Odysseus would choose to be a common man, an ordinary man, not a hero. And Ur chose to be himself and return to his family, and he did, and that was the end of the story. Plato told that story in all gravity at the end of the Republic. And I don't have a payoff here so much, Germanicus, as to say that story makes me doubt Plato is more than a very, very, very successful, and like the Mark Twain of the 4th century, spellbinding, a good storyteller, but not anybody to trust for government. Because in my reading of the 7th letter, and there were 13 letters, some of them are not real, some of them are, and most of them are real, according to a debate that's been going on for 2,500 years, for heaven's sakes. every generation condemns or approves of the Republic. My observation is that we in the United States, despite our vanity of having a republic, representative speakers going to Washington and hashing out government for all of us with checks and balances, despite our vanity, we have a tyranny, alternate tyranny, and it's balanced. It goes this way, it goes that way, it goes back and forth. Certainly, you could say, in a rough way, the Biden administration went to the left with dictation. Now the Trump Republican administration going to the right with dictation, the diktat. It's not checks and balances. It's not three articles of the Constitution and the different branches treating each other with respect. It's, I want this to happen, and then after the next election, I want that to happen. And that makes me disappointed if we think we're following your measurement.
It seems, to me at least, that Plato is a kind of Elmer Gantry of his day without the fire and brimstone. And I would never have thought that at all without the opportunity to see his epistles, especially this seventh letter, and realize that he's not only just a guy trying to get by, but also a guy who has to defend his reputation and who has obligations to continue to show his relevance and his claim to be, if not oracular, because he never claims that, then to have, like a seer, of this intense insight. And so what's interesting about this letter is that he is, first of all, of necessity trying to defend his position and to explain all the things he did in Syracuse, like trying to teach Dionysius, and then supporting the new tyrant who overthrew him. And it shows a guy who is just a guy. And that is cool, because Plato is so strangely elevated in our discourse. But the third thing, though, is I never realized how mystical Plato could be in his thought. And this gets back to the Elmer Gantry analogy, in the sense that he was kind of a preacher, and he wasn't going to let his new student, Dionysius, teach him anything. And he wasn't going to accept the fact that this guy, this kid, would be uppity. And so it reveals a very human Plato, and it also shows in its own way the need for Greek Hellenistic civilization at that time to provide this larger sense of meaning and to explain the cosmos. And so it's rather interesting that way. And finally, you see Plato navigating the shoals and eddies and currents of contemporary politics and trying to make sense of them, in contrast to his kind of framing of a more perfect representation, which of course he presents in the Republic. And so he's trying to bring some sense to politics and make it a little bit better than what it actually is. And it's actually not very nice. And this gets to your point about dictatorship, is that within politics as we know it today, and probably always, this has always been so, is that politics is about power, and power is fleeting, if not evanescent. And so it is open to abuse. And typically, there is no balanced situation as the founders, the American founders, would have hoped, in which no individual could gain a position of lasting power over others. And of course, that is true in America even now. There is no lasting tyranny. No tyrant is able to hold sway for more than a few years. And so in that sense, the system works. But it does seem as though this truth is inescapable. Even, for example, in the Roman Republic, which, well, we can only guess at what Plato might have thought of the Roman Republic at its height. But even there, you know, you had a tendency toward an unraveling of comity and of a sense of collegiality between senators, and a movement eventually toward a more oligarchic system, and then ultimately toward a dictatorship. And it gives one pause.
I'm remembering that the Romans were aware, certainly were they aware of Plato, but I don't believe they made a cult of Plato. That came during the Enlightenment.
Yeah. Right.
So our tradition of Plato is much more involved and sober than the Roman position, is my memory, but I haven't read about Rome reflecting on Plato. Now, there is Plutarch to mention, first century contemporary of ours, born under Claudius or Nero, one or the other, and living until Hadrian's time. And Plutarch's Lives defend Dion, the brother-in-law who eventually becomes the hero to Plato,
right,
and then disappoints everybody by being a usual
another tyrant. Yeah, right.
Plutarch defended Dion, and you sort of eliminated certain points where he used political assassination to retain power. So I'm going to guess that Plutarch was influential, is going to be influential to the Roman world. And really, the idea of defending a despot doesn't come naturally to Greeks. It does to us Romans. When we get an emperor we like, we don't care what he's up to.
Well, you're citing Plutarch, I think, is really essential here, because it brings to the fore the salient countervailing element in Greco-Roman polity, and that is the dominance of an idealized model person.
Right.
And the fact that that model person is the thing to which you, the ambitious young man who is quite willing to become a tyrant if possible, should aspire to. And therefore, that model as an ideal becomes, in its own literary and rhetorical fashion, the primary element of restraint. And it actually operates as such. And this brings to mind the fact that the Roman Republic, at its most successful, also its earlier days before it became too big and too rich, had that ethos, a great Greek word, as its lodestar. And it actually worked. So the image of Cincinnatus, Horatius at the bridge, And other model men actually did serve as a break on excessive behavior. But it's interesting that in the Roman world, that actually worked, even when there weren't as many actual political breaks and counterbalances. And what is sad and revealing about our time is that we do not have a model that we collectively applaud and long to follow. And what worries me most about our society right now is not so much the form of tyranny, but rather the spirit of tyranny, and the fact that a society that has no model of ideal behavior and restraint and humanity, which, of course, the Greco-Roman world enshrined, ours is a society in which major excess is always right around the corner. And we know this from looking at the world of Europe in the 20th century and Hitler and Stalin. And then, of course, Mao, et cetera, et cetera. So this is, there is some great quality to Greco-Roman civilization, and I think you just identified it through Plutarch.
Recommending to the audience, watch Failsafe, then watch Strangelove, and laugh. Just laugh. It didn't happen then. Germanicus is Marco Vlahos. This is Live. I am John Batzer, Gaius. We're going on to the God, the sacrifice of the god Augustus, who's our perfect emperor. Yeah, he was a dictator, but he was smart, too. He had trouble with his daughter. Everybody can sympathize with him in retrospect. And then we're going on to the theater, and I have reason to believe we're going to see Scenes from the Clouds. That's Aristophanes' idea of a comedy. The part that is funny is the thinkery, the thinkery supervised by Socrates, where all the bums and wastrels of society gather, the thinkery, capital T. This is the Friends of History Debating Society. I'm John Batzer.